Native English speakers don't realize how lucky they have it. Just about every person who learns English as a second language comments on just how difficult it can be to learn. And it's not like native English speakers are all that good at it either. Poor grammar aside, we do get into plenty of arguments over word use, arguments that are illuminated and examined in a book by today's guest. The book, now out in paperback, is called Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. Ammon Shea is the author. He lives in a world of words. He helps compile and edit dictionaries, and he's written several books of his own, including Reading the OED and Depraved and Insulting English. Ammon Shea, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Great. Thank you for having me.
You are a lexicographer then, is that right?
Well, I would say I'm a lexicographic researcher. I'm typically not engaged in the day-to-day business of defining words. I just do research for dictionary companies.
And how'd you get into that field?
Well, very logically, I think I was a furniture mover. to me, there's a very logical progression because pretty much almost anything is preferable to carrying pianos up fifth floor walk-ups. And so I had been a furniture mover for some good amount of time, and I thought I would really rather do something else. And the first idea that came to me was reading the OED and writing a book about it, and that kind of got me into the field of lexicography.
All right, so we have to back up to that point. You actually read the entire Oxford English Dictionary?
I did. It took about a year, and I read the, I think, 21,730 pages. The most recent print form, now they're just editing it online, so it would be much more difficult to read online, but yeah.
So it took a year, you said, but and how many words or how many letters did you get through in a given day?
I don't know. I didn't really keep track day to day of how much I was going through. It was just, you know, I would read maybe 10 hours a day, I very much love to read, and it's a spectacularly exciting reading dictionary because it's has several million citations from great literature and not so great literature that the dictionary uses to kind of demonstrate how our language is formed. So you're really reading books just little bit by bit, and not in any kind of plot specific order. But it's a great dictionary just to dip into and read if you're ever curious about how they work.
Did you go consecutively, or did you think, I want to do L today?
I read from A to Z.
Wow. So back to the subject of your own book, Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation, you point out that, yes, people often say that English is going to hell in a handbasket, but it sounds like we're not new at this.
Right. Well, that's my favorite point to make, is that people have been saying we're going to hell in a handbasket for 400 or 500 years now, which really means that either we are in a very slow handbasket or we are not actually going to ever get there. One of my other favorite points, I think, to make is that you frequently will hear people say, I care about language. And I think that that's usually a kind of euphemistic shorthand for saying instead what they mean, which is, I like to tell other people that they're wrong. And it's an impulse that is shared by many of us. We all have this kind of notion that language can be, in some way, absolutely correct. That there's a utopian place we will get to wherein everybody speaks in perfectly formed sentences, and nobody ends them with prepositions. This is, unfortunately, a myth. Language does not work that way. It never has, and it never will. And you will never fix the English language. The only languages that are ever effectively fixed are the ones that are dead and which nobody speaks anymore. So, for instance, Latin, or ancient Latin, changes very little anymore because it has not been a lingua franca, no pun intended, for 1,000 years or more.
So your other radio appearances apparently contributed to the writing of this book?
That's true, yes. One of the things that when I was being interviewed about reading the OED, one of the things I said was, you know, I've never come away from reading a dictionary feeling stupider. And I've been getting all this really angry email, and even letters. People would still write me letters, and my publisher would very helpfully forward them on to me. And they all pretty much said, you know, you sounded like a charming and intelligent young fellow, and then I heard you use the word stupider, and I've decided that you're nothing but a fool, and I will never listen to anything you have to say on the subject of language or anything else. And I was really, as the British would say, kind of gobsmacked. I absolutely had no idea that stupider was considered to be not a word. And so I decided to look into, why is stupider not a word? I mean, smarter is certainly a word, and many other kind of comparative adjectives work very
dumber,
well.
Dumber, right? Yeah.
And there is no good explanation, as it turns out. There has never been written in any guide or grammar book or anything, you know, an explanation of that, well, A, that this is a rule. It seems to be kind of a rule that's just passed on. People know this, but you won't see it in, you know, in a grammar book typically. And there are also a number of words which are really, morphologically, they're almost identical to stupider. So, for instance, polite is the same kind of thing. It's a two-syllable additive, what we would call a disyllabic comparative form that ends with a velar stop, meaning you end the word by touching your tongue to the palate right behind your teeth, on the top of your mouth. Polite, stupid, they're formed the same way. Politer, you know, people aren't usually going to say, you know, you're an idiot, you said politer. Yet somehow, if you say the word stupider, a number of people, in at least my experience, will feel very comfortable saying, you're really a fool. And this is just so peculiar to me that such an arbitrary rule is taking up space in so many people's lives.
Do people tend to be a bit exclusionary in the sense that when they hear somebody use certain words or sets of words, they sort of assume things about them, their social status or their education?
Sure. Right. They're taken as kind of shibboleths, so to speak, markers of intelligence, reading, class. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about language, and my personal belief is as to why we are so judgmental, is that if I sit down and I'm having a dinner conversation with you, you're telling me all kinds of things about what you know about language just by speaking. You're not telling me anything about what you know about physics or history unless you specifically reference those things, but you're kind of wearing your linguistic education on your sleeve, and we take advantage of that.
All right, we'll come back and talk more with Ammon Shea about his book, Bad English. Ammon, we're going to hang up on you for just a moment and pick up on another line to try to clear up some audio noise we're getting. But we'll be back in the Jefferson Exchange talking to Ammon Shea and our listeners as well in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Ammon Shea. He's the author of a book called Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. It's now out in paperback. It's an exploration of the ways in which we use words and phrases that drive other people up a wall. Are they necessarily incorrect usages? And is usages even a word? We'll explore that as well with Ammon Shea. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Ammon, I think we have you back on a better line now. There was a bit of a crackling there. Oh, sounds great. So when you started this project, I mean, did you start as a neutral observer or do you have some axes of your own to grind? It sounds like with the stupid thing you...
I do. I do have my own peeve. My own peeve is the very fact that other people like to correct language. Most people in who are concerned with dictionaries, we really tend to try to be impartial observers. And the fact is all languages change. And it's very interesting to study linguistic change. It's interesting to see how words shift meaning. And there are very few words in our language that have had the same meaning for more than several hundred years without picking up other words. And so it's difficult for me to listen to people say, you know, that is wrong when you use the word that way. For instance, a great, because we're always inconsistent with it. So a great example is that you don't have to go very far before you can find somebody who complains about how young people use the word awesome. And the complaint usually goes something like this. They say awesome for everything, and they're not talking about things that have awe. And this is true. They're not, in fact, you know, when some kid says, did you get me a soda? And the other kid says, yeah. And he says, awesome. There is very little awe in that statement. That is true. However, my experience and the people who complain about this have no such compunction about using the word awful. And it is very rare that when you say awful that you actually mean that is something that is filled with awe. And that is actually the meaning that it used to have. So we see no inconsistency in condemning somebody for saying awesome, while sometimes we even actually say, that is an awful thing you said, and we don't
pay attention to the fact that we are in fact using an almost identical word form that has changed. And so we're selectively comfortable with linguistic change.
You mentioned that there are two camps of people, one of which you mentioned already, the people like to correct other people's language. And what's the other camp?
Well, I think they're the ones who do not like to correct other people's language, really. And lexicographers and linguists tend to fall into that second camp, wherein it's they will take note of linguistic change, but they're not trying to stop it.
So as an observer, then, you're taking the position, it sounds like, that language is fluid, that people will begin to use it differently over time, and that's okay because language does evolve in that way. Is that the general position?
Absolutely. And that is true both for grammatical functions. We change syntax. I mean, you know, one of the things that is interesting is people always say, you know, they have this not people always say, but it is frequent that you hear people say that, you know, at some indeterminate point in the past, we were much more eloquent, we were much better read, and they, you know, things are going wrong today. So there's this feeling among many people who are concerned with language use that that it would be preferable to go back to an earlier time. I find it notable that they never want to go back to the point of Old English, during which we had 8 possible, you know, inflections for every noun. You know, it was an enormously complex language. It would be really very difficult for us to kind of go back to something like that. So we want to go back. We just want to go back to where we feel comfortable. Not further than that. So there's, it's very difficult for me to accept that, you know, that at any given point in the past, language was right. It's always in flux. And so a great example of this is you would hear people often complaining about, you know, kids use today, they'll start a sentence with like. Like is meaningless. Well, I think that's terrible. Except that 100 years ago, what grammarians were complaining about was people starting a sentence with the word well. And they said, well is a mere meaningless prelude to a sentence. So the difference between starting a sentence with like and starting a sentence with well, as far as I'm concerned, is your grandparents use well and your grandchildren use like. But functionally, they're the exact same word. So very little has changed in how we kind of abuse the language, just that we often have the feeling that something worse is happening today.
It's amazing to think about that, though, that, you know, you think about our Victorian predecessor saying, well, it's good to see you today. And you can just imagine their, you know, great-grandkids going, like, it's good to see you.
Yeah. It's very, very similar.
We have a call here from Sig in Gold Hill. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Ammon Shea, the author of Bad English. Hi, Sig.
Hi. I have one little pet peeve that I'd like an opinion on. Every English-speaking person I hear on the radio and everywhere else uses the slang word gonna instead of going to, and it's ubiquitous. Politicians, heads of state, on-air anchors who are obviously reading something, and I don't think that they write it up as gonna, but they say it that way. It's just crazy. What do you think about that?
Actually, I have known news anchors who did write gonna on there because the consultants told them that it sounded more conversational. So, yes, some of them do. Some of them will actually see going to and still read gonna. But that's mm-hmm. That's from our side of the microphone. But what do you think about all that, Ammon?
Well, I think it's one of the things that's interesting about this is that we actually have very little idea of how people spoke more than 100 years ago. We don't actually have records. We don't have video or much audio. So I would say that's just either a regionalism or it's a pronunciation variation or something like that. And it could be sloppy, but also people speak very differently than they write. And that's always been the case. We just we kind of know this, but we don't have too much evidence of how, say, people spoke in conversation, or if they were to be broadcasting something 150 years ago, how would they have spoken? It seems not outside the realm of possibility to me that they would have said gonna for going to. I think that is, it's just kind of a pronunciation quirk, perhaps. But I don't begrudge you your right to be peeved or upset by it in any way.
Did you apply some consistent tests to the uses of English that are used in the book? I mean, was there a particular investigative set of procedures you used every time you were looking up one of these words or phrases?
No, I was largely just looking for things that annoy people and trying to find why do they annoy people. you know, for instance, irregardless. People, why are we so upset about irregardless? There are some interesting things about irregardless. It has been written, we now know, since at least 1795, so it's been around for quite a while. It is a kind of nonsensical word. You do have a meaningless prefix. The IR, extra IR prefix, is, however, not the only word in English that is formed with a kind of superfluous prefix. I mean, valuable and invaluable are very, very similar. So are habitable and inhabitable. So sometimes, you know, English will pick up these kind of double words like that. I still don't know exactly why the IR, regardless, bothers people to the extent that it does. And I'm not making the suggestion that it is standard English or that I would ever use it in, say, a paper or a written book. Or, you know, I'm not defending it on those merits. I'm just trying to find out where did it come from and why does it get people so het up, as they say.
Well, and it's just the addition of two letters, and I can actually testify to the fact that sometimes the addition of one letter can drive you up a wall. When I moved from New York to Connecticut, we went from all the people saying anyway to a whole state of people who said anyways. And
right.
There were even some people who mm-hmm. said somewheres, anywheres. You know, they added mm-hmm. S's to just about everything. Did you get into that?
I did not get so much into that. I think that those kind of regionalisms tend to not... Well, I don't think that they spread so much as to bother people. I think that I was trying to morphify the things that are taught, you know, to our young language learners as correct or incorrect. You know, for instance, particularly the things that, to my mind, I guess, don't really make sense. For instance, this notion, which is, again, fairly widespread, that impact should never be used as a verb. You know, I think that it obviously is used as a verb. People use impact as a verb all the time, and it also bothers people all the time. Now, I think it's fine if you want to be bothered by impact as a verb. I think it would be nice to bear in mind several things. One is that it's actually been a verb for about 200 years longer than it's been a noun. Impact started in the English language as a verb in 1601. It wasn't used as a noun until the end of the 18th century, almost 200 years later. The other is that it doesn't ever, in my mind, make sense to say that is not a verb, like impact is not a verb. You can say it's not a verb that I agree with, or it's a verbal sense that I find problematic, you know, but to me, saying that's not a word or saying that's not a verb, something rather obviously is. It's a little bit like saying that's not a car when a car is about to run over you. It's really wishful thinking, and it won't actually change things.
Ammon Shea is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book, now out in paperback, is called Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. I think he's trying to bait us just with the subtitle. But you can have our discussion. You can be part of this discussion about language and its use. 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760, or jx@jeffnet.org. This whole section on nouns turning into verbs is the one that we should call this the section most likely to get Jeff's wife Joy to call, because she... golfing and things like that, you just really puts the nails to the blackboard. But as you were talking about impact, for example, you know, how does this impact us? It got me to thinking about some other recent ways in which we've had nouns become verbs and verbs become nouns as well. Because, for example, you've got task. I'm going to task you with this this duty. And the other one is ask, where I know this is a big ask, where there you've got a verb becoming a noun.
Right. That happens all the time. In fact, I would go so far as to say there are hundreds of thousands of words in English that have multiple roles like this. It's a process that the linguists and their everlasting charm refer to as functional shift, and it's when a word decides, I've had enough of this part of speech, I'm going to try out being another part of speech for a while. And all languages do this pretty well. English does it spectacularly well. One of the reasons why Shakespeare, for instance, is credited with having invented so many words, well, he did, you know, he was very fanciful with language, he was very playful with language, but one of the things that he did more than anybody else was he would take a word and he would just change the part of speech, and he was the first one, for instance, and to use monster, which was at that point only a noun, as a verb. I'm not exactly sure what he meant by I'll monster you, but he was definitely using a noun as a verb. He does that hundreds of times. And this is, I'm not entirely certain why, but it is something that does bother a lot of people, selectively. It's very difficult to use words, a sentence that is free of words that don't have multiple parts of speech. English, for instance. English can be an adjective, it can be a noun, it can be a verb, you know. You can English something. I mean, something is very English. I mean, it's very few words kind of hold on to one part of speech and then are happy with their lot of life.
It becomes a sort of shorthand, it sounds like, just that you get your message across by using that word in a different context, and people go, oh, I know what that means.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Another email here from Mike in Medford. He says, I don't have too many pet peeves concerning the English language. However, the double negative drives me crazy, and it only seems to be getting more use on popular media. I didn't do nothing. So you did something, writes Mike in Medford.
Uh-huh. Well, I disagree with you. Now, one of the things that I think comes up sometimes, particularly with the double negative, is that it is very easy to find examples that are egregious and don't really make sense. I didn't do nothing. Sure. There are a few among us who would say, oh, yeah, that's really eloquent. You know, we might say that's colloquial. We might say that's regionalism. We might say that's indicative of a particular class or socioeconomic strata, linguistic register, whatever. Very few of us are going to actually defend it. However, that is not to say that, therefore, all double negatives are unpleasant or wrong. If I say that something is a not unlovely picture, I think that that does convey a shade of nuance that would be otherwise difficult to say with only positives or with only one negative. There's a number of interesting works that have been done with, for instance, double negative shades of meaning in what is referred to in literature as AAVE, African American Vernacular English. And as a linguistic register, there are ways of shading things with double negative in African American Vernacular English that would be very difficult to do otherwise, and that are, in fact, quite eloquent. I'm a big fan of the double negatives. I use them as often as I can.
The example you give, I do like as well, the not unlovely and, the variations of that. Another call here. Let's go to Brian in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ammon Shea, the author of Bad English.
Hi, thank you. On the very point of shades of meaning, one of my pet peeves is the word absolutely, which people now use as a synonym for yes, even though like certainly and exactly and positively, they all originally had different shades of meaning for saying yes, and it's being lost with absolutely, and I wonder what you both think of that.
All right, thanks for that, Brian.
Well, sure, you are losing shades of meaning. However, in many other ways, you are gaining shades of meaning. And I don't know exactly where those shades are being gained. They may not be gained in the exact word that is losing shades of meaning. But this is a general pattern of language. Some words will come to mean something else. Some people will still use absolutely in the sense that you want to preserve. She can come up with a sentence pretty well. An example of that, but absolutely is not losing absolutely. Yeah, I'll use it right there.
It hasn't come to mean something else.
Absolutely losing its meaning. You will understand its old meaning if it's used in that context. You will not say, wait a minute. He sounds like he's talking about the thorough, completion of something, but he's actually saying yes. No, we're not losing one meaning entirely. We're just adding another meaning, which is this. And I think it's something that all of us have the ability to do what is often referred to as code switch, which is, you can change linguistic registers very easily. When you're talking with your friends after school, you speak in a very different register of English than when you were writing a letter to your grandmother. And so you might hear absolutely at the beginning of a sentence when somebody says, did you get the reports done for the meeting? Absolutely, I got them done. Or will you get them done? Absolutely. And then if you want to talk about absolutely finishing something to the very last minute, you can use absolutely in another sense. I think your audience will generally know what you mean. So, I'm not going to say don't be bothered by it, and don't feel like you have to use it in that sense, but I don't think that it's really deteriorating the language so much.
One of the biggest ones comes up right in the front of the book, and that is the use of the term hopefully instead of it is hoped that. So this one really shot to the top of the charts. It stayed there for a long time, didn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, one of the things that I thought was great was the Associated Press in 2012, and I think they were kind of trolling people by the fact, you know, they issued it in a tweet, which again, I think they, as opposed to doing it on a villain scroll or with a Herald or something. And they issued a tweet that said, they tweeted, we now support the modern usage of hopefully, which to many people was the end of their own personal culture war. One of the things I think is kind of funny about this is that this modern use began in 1648 in the translation of Montaigne's Essays, the first instance we know of hopefully used in the sense of, it is to be hoped.
Wow, 1648, you said?
1648 is the first use of hopefully as a sentence adverb.
Wow.
Which is the way that it gets people very worked up these days.
So not a modern usage at all. And then I'll come back to usage and grammar, what those mean, when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Ammon Shea, the author of Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. Back with Ammon and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about language today, and that always seems to light up the phone lines, and it has done so again today. We're talking to Ammon Shea, the author of Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. Aggravation or irritation? We'll have to examine that one as well. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the ways in which the language is used. In the opinion of some people, it is mangled. In the opinion of others, hey, we've been doing this for a long time, which is often what Ammon has been finding out. We just talked about, for example, hopefully first turning up in the use that people mean it is hoped that way back in 1648. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at this phone number, 800-838-3760, or this email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So grammar and usage, I talked about this just before the break. You do identify a difference between those in the book.
Sure. I mean, to me, grammar is really kind of the structure of your sentences, the building blocks of language. Usage is it's a question of, say, subject, verb, order. It's a grammatical issue that in French they might say the car green, and we say the green car, sentence order and things like that. Questions of whether a verb needs to agree in number with its noun, et cetera. Usage is more a question of, can unique mean more than one thing? Or does unique have to mean one of its kind and there is no other one in the entire universe? That's a question of usage, whether words can carry different meaning than we think they do. And I think there is a difference between these two, though they certainly both change over time. And neither grammar nor usage will ever remain static in a living language.
Ultimately, then, you're not an absolutist. I mean, if people want to say unique or very unique or any of those things, it's like, well, this happens, but you're not going to be like the referee, like, cut that out.
Right. I have no desire to referee other people's language. Unique is a wonderful example of how difficult it is to prescribe rules for language. The issue with unique that many people have is that it's what is referred to as an absolute adjective. This is a classic word, of which it is commonly thought that it has but one possible meaning. So that it would be kind of a contradiction in terms. It'd be like saying that, you're somewhat pregnant and to say that you're somewhat unique. And that's understandable, and I can certainly relate to this desire for constancy. My problem is that I think with language, we're really doing the wrong thing when we're looking for constancy in language. It's just not a constant thing. So a great case of this is that back in the 19th century, a number of grammarians were kind of trying to grasp, come to terms with this language thing and come to terms with absolute adjectives in particular. And they made this long list of things that were absolute adjectives, just like unique. So, for instance, dry, wet, straight, flat, equal, clear, sober, drunk, evident, correct, quiet, true, empty, full, steady, square, invariable. I mean, they had dozens and dozens of words. They said these words are absolute. They do not permit any variation of form. And, you know, we really haven't paid that much attention to them. A great example would be perfect. You're either perfect or you're not. Except look at the opening line of the introduction to the Constitution, in order to create a more perfect union. Well, what is more perfect? Well, this just means that we're using a kind of broadened sense of the word perfect in our earliest government documents.
So we could actually get to perfecter, like stupider?
Sure. James, I wouldn't put it past us at some point in the future to think that we will go with perfect care.
Perfecter.
Things about that.
Right. You heard it here first. Okay, so you talked about hopefully another one that really drives some people up the wall of the use of the term literally as it has been used, particularly in recent years. And I think the AP caved on this one too, didn't it?
I don't know if they did or didn't, but if they have not, it doesn't really matter because pretty much everybody else has. I mean, this is literally is being used, and what bothers people is that it's being used as an intensifier. I think it is the fact that it seems to be almost opposite of figuratively. I don't think it is actually opposite. It's just very dissimilar from figurative, and it's being used essentially to mean figuratively, or being used, as I said, just as an intensifier. We have been doing this for a very long time as well. I mean, Mark Twain and the great scene in Tom Sawyer, where Tom has just managed to bamboozle a bunch of neighborhood kids into whitewashing Aunt Polly's fence, and he even convinces them to give him all kinds of things, about, you know, broken marble and a dead rat as payment for this. And it says at the end of the day, Tom was literally swimming in loot. So we are not led to believe that Tom, he was literally rolling in loot, I think. But there's no indication that Tom's actually rolling around on the ground. So Twain was using this to mean figurative. Vladimir Nabokov uses it to mean something very figurative. In Invitation to a Beheading, he used the line, and with his eyes, he scoured the corners of his cell. The protagonist in this case has not actually ripped his eyes from his head and is not furiously rubbing them against the walls, scouring. It's a very figurative sense of the word. So a lot of people do use it figuratively, and a lot of people don't like that, which is okay. But I think that they might need to accept that this is a word whose meaning and use is very much still in transition.
You know, it's one of those things, though, that for those of us who do write copy for a living, that you end up shying away from a term like that. You know, we can say it literally saw thousands of fish go over the falls or something. You can't say that anymore because literally has been used to this extent.
The word gets skunked. And that would be a much greater shame were it not for the fact that you only have about 800,000 other English words to choose from. You know, I mean,
and you've read them all.
Right, in terms of a large language, English is an exceedingly large language. I mean, most what are commonly thought of as large vocabulary languages tend to have around 150,000 words. I mean, English is 4, 5, 6 times that many. Nobody really knows. But we have no shortage of words at our disposal, so that if one or two get skunked by people using them in a fashion that is thought of as improper, it's really not the end of the world.
Johnny in Tequilma emailed, he says, I've increasingly been hearing the use of the double past tense, sometimes by people who should know better, such as he has went instead of either he went or he has gone. Is that just a grammar thing?
I would say, and to me, it does sound like originalism. I'm not terribly familiar with that. And to be honest, I've in fact never heard anybody complain about it before.
You know, speaking of regionalisms like that, it reminds me that when I lived in the South, you'd often get phone calls from people would say, have him to call me.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And again, that's probably, you know, there's probably a spoken, a colloquial use there that I very much doubt that most of those people would then use that particular construction in writing. We all speak differently than we write. And if you ever want to really humble yourself, have somebody audio tape you just talking in a regular setting without you knowing it, and then actually transcribe what you say.
Oh, I see. But, you know, Just even from the Nixon tapes, that's just scary.
It's mortifying when you take the words that you unknowingly spoke, that you didn't know were recorded, and when you actually write them down on paper. We all speak in sentence fragments. We all use ridiculous phrases. We all use poor word choice, improper grammar. I mean, just on and on and on. It's very, very different than the way that we write. Even if we're not practiced at writing, it's just writing is so much more considered, non-extemporaneous thing that, and this is one of the reasons why my speech is so different from writing.
Let's take another call. Here's Patricia in Roseburg. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ammon Shea, the author of Bad English.
Hi. I have a pet peeve with people using the word me as a subject matter instead of a direct object, like me and my dad went to the store instead of my dad and I. And it seems it's really a common thing. You hear it all the time on television, everything, everyone. It's always me.
Yes, that is true, and that in some definite sense would be viewed as incorrect. We have been butchering these things for hundreds of years, and between you and I is a common one that people dislike. Even though Shakespeare uses it in the Merchant of Venice, I don't know if he used it because he was making a mistake or if it just fit the meter better. But yeah, people are definitely misusing objective subjective cases quite frequently. I wish I could tell you there was a way to make it better, but I can't.
Language is fluid. It was always the answer. It just keeps changing. Let's go to Marilyn in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. I have an issue with the change of the English usage from something like, it's important that you be here. It's important that you are here, which is not the same meaning. And so I wonder, is it incorrect for me to still use that terminology? Because it makes so much sense that having studied Spanish and French, there is a subjunctive, and English subjunctive seems to have been outlawed. Seems like lately nobody is using it anymore. So I wonder if I will sound antiquated if I say important that you be here.
Oh, excellent point. You know, whether by using something that was once correct, you end up sounding like somebody who's way out of date. Thanks for that.
That is an interesting question. I don't think you sound antiquated personally. I would say I'm middle-aged, so maybe I'm straddling the young and the old uses. I think that you sound entirely natural saying it is important that you be here. I haven't noticed that particular shift, so I would definitely take your word for it. Things are always changing. However, I think that they change slowly enough that we more notice the new ones than notice that people are speaking in old things. My experience looking back at grammar manuals and usage guides is typically that there's a 50 to 100 year kind of gap during which things, that's the point at which things will frequently seem kind of ridiculous to us. And it's not all the rules, but for instance, the fact that in the 1950s, it was considered, the word balding was considered to be a ridiculous word. That will seem odd to us today. You know, it's 50, 60, 70 years ago. The fact that in the beginning of the 20th century, zoom was considered to be a word that should only mean upward motion. You would never zoom in a straight line towards somebody because zoom has to mean going up. That seems kind of curious to us, but I also think it's mainly the things that people prescribe against that seem kind of like antiquated rules, but just the usage of it is important that you be here. I don't think that would sound antiquated to us.
All right, to the subtitle of the book, A History of Linguistic Aggravation, and I should point out that my mother used to get really annoyed when people said, oh, I'm just so aggravated, because she said, no, you're irritated.
Right, that's a good point, except that the original meaning of irritate was to rouse somebody to action. The issue that your mother and many other people, including currently the New York Times, oddly enough, have with aggravate is that it properly is a medical term or it's something which means to make something worse. And it should never, under any circumstances, be used to mean to bother or irk somebody. It's But again, if we look at the close synonyms, irritate used to mean rouse to action. Exasperate used to mean to make worse. Kind of like aggravate used to mean to make worse. So aggravate is not the only word that has changed its close in the middle of its performance here. And if you really want to be a stickler about it, the original first meaning of aggravate it was used as an adjective, and it was it meant threatened with excommunication from the Catholic Church. Needless to say, this is not the use that many of us use today. And then its first use as a verb meant to weigh down, because it actually comes from the Latin word aggravare, meaning to weigh down in Latin. So, again, this is us very selectively picky about what a word should mean. You know, we want it to mean the thing that we think it should mean, but we are not being in any way, typically, consistent with saying, yes, the word will change, and all words change. So, you know, so therefore, if everybody uses it, it's okay. We tend to say all words change, but they only change to the point at which I want them to stop, and then that's it, because I read in the book somewhere that this is the preferred meaning of this word. Again, language does not really work this way. And the one thing I would really like to say to everybody who likes to complain about language, it's totally fine with me if you want. You should, I think, however, realize that by the time enough people are saying something in numbers that are sufficient for you to notice it and be bothered by it, it's too late to change it back.
So you're stuck. Language is fluid, and if you're noticing it, it's already flowed away from you. The book is called Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. It is in paperback now. Ammon Shea wrote it, and he joined us on The Exchange today. Ammon, it's a good time. Thanks for joining us.